Welcome, and thank you for joining today's California ISO Board of Governors meeting. Before we begin, please ensure you have opened the WebEx participant and chat panels by using the associated icons located at the bottom of your screen. Please note that all lines will be muted until we break for Q&A. You will receive instructions on how to ask a question at that time. And if you require technical assistance, please send a private message to the event producer. With that, I'll turn the call over to David Olson, Board Chair. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for attending this special meeting of the California ISO Board of Governors. To get started, I'd like Mr. Collington to call the roll, please.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Let me go ahead and take roll. Chair Olson?
Present.
Governor Golitova?
Present.
Governor Bhagwat?
Present.
Governor Borenstein?
Present.
And Governor Leslie?
Present.
Thank you, Governors. Chair Olson, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Collington. I'd like to explain the agenda and format for today's meeting. And we will have a presentation for the first part of the meeting by ISO management. And then we will have a public comment period. Due to the large volume of participants today, attendees today, the comments will be limited to no more than 2 minutes. Hopefully there'll be questions rather than comments. But because of the priority of our activity managing the grid today actively, we must end this meeting promptly at 12:30. There will be a media advisory question and answer session available beginning at 1:30 today that will provide much more opportunity for questions and comments at that time. So that's how we'll proceed, and I'd like to turn the meeting over to our CEO, Steve Bebrick. Steve?
Thank you, Chair Olson. Governors, if you'll indulge me, I have a few things I'd like to say to start the meeting. I think it's important for everyone to understand that the ISO operates the system it is given, the system that is authorized by the Public Utility Commission and procured by the load-serving entities. The ISO does not direct procurement. We are the system operator. The situation we are in could have been avoided. For many years, we have pointed out to the procurement authorizing authorities that there was inadequate power available during the net peak. That is the load after the solar has left the system. We have indicated in filing after filing after filing that the resource adequacy program was broken and needed to be fixed. That program requires the load serving entities to only procure to a 50-50 weather forecast. That is the worst weather you might have on average 50% of the time, not to an extreme heat storm like we have now. They also are required to procure to the afternoon peak, and they do virtually nothing to address, and the RA program does virtually nothing to address requirements to serve load after the sun goes down and the solar is gone. Both the Friday night and Saturday night outages were during the evening hours when solar is gone and load is still heavy on the system. We told the Public Utility Commission that there was a developing capacity shortfall of 4,700 megawatts through 2022 and that the gap started in 2020. We even undertook noticed ex parte communication with the commissioners on the matter. Despite all that, only 3,300 megawatts was authorized for procurement and not starting till 2021. The bet has been that uncontracted imports will fill any void. We have told regulators over and over again that imports were drying up, and the more imports should be contracted for. That was rebuffed. And here we are, facing diminished imports because the rest is hot too. There simply isn't enough power to import to fill the void. And no, batteries won't fix this alone. They will help, and they're part and part of the renewable heavy system. However, they don't generate any power, and during extended periods of cloud cover over the solar fields, there won't be any energy to charge them, and we're going to be back in load shedding conditions again. In fact, solar and other renewables will have to be overbuilt to both charge the batteries and serve the load at the same time. To fix this, resource adequacy must be reformed so that every hour of the year is properly resourced. System, local, and flexible resources need to be contracted for on a longer-term basis. All load-serving entities must procure to their local needs across all hours. All load-serving entities. The load forecast needs to reflect the realities of climate change. It's getting hotter. Unfortunately, it is near certain that we'll be forced to ask the utilities to cut off power to millions today to balance supply and demand today and tomorrow and perhaps beyond. We already predict the demand today and tomorrow will greatly exceed supply. We loathe cutting off power and do it as a last resort. We know this disrupts lives, risks health, and is economically damaging. For those of you who think we can just use our reserves, you are wrong. You are trading the loss of 3,000 megawatts for the collapse of the entire system in California and perhaps the entire West. We knew it would be a close call on Friday and Saturday evenings and thought we would be able to serve all load well, and we thought that well into the afternoon. But the unanticipated loss of resources close to the peak made it impossible. We should have prepared the public, the utilities, state authorities, and particularly the governor's office for the possibility of outages on Friday and Saturday much more ahead of time. We own that and are sorry we didn't do more. Today, you're going to hear more about what the existing fleet can do. People often wonder how we made it through the 2006 heat storm and we can't this one. It's quite simple. There was a lot more generating capacity on the system in 2006 than there is in 2020. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Steve. We'll go on to the presentation.
Good morning, everybody. My name is John Phipps. I'm the Director of Real-Time Operations for the California ISO. Here at the California ISO. I'm just going to review the events of Friday and Saturday and then a brief outlook for today and tomorrow. Next slide, please. The ISO, as all other utilities in the United States, operate off of have many principles they have to operate by. NERC, the National Energy Regulatory Commission, has standards. Our regional entity has standards, WEC. We have the California ISO tariff, and then we have operating procedures. All of these guide us on how to operate the grid and actions to take when we risk reliability. Listed here are from our operating procedure 4420, the steps that we activate as we are approaching some sort of an emergency in the grid. I won't read them to you. They are available publicly on the website under operating procedure 4420. Next slide, please. This is a timeline of events that led up to Friday's load shedding. We got a heads up a week early that we were going to see a strong heat wave coming from starting Friday, August 14th, following into the next week. As we kept approaching closer every day towards Friday, August 14th, the temperatures were going up and the load forecasts were going up. Wednesday morning, August 12th, we issued a restricted maintenance operations per our operating procedure 4420 to return any outages that we could on the grid, either transmission or generation, and then cancel or reschedule any other planned work. We communicated with all of our participating transmission owners and generator owners and let our neighboring utilities know also. Then on Thursday, August 13th, after the day at market closed, we saw that it was infeasible for 2 hours, hour ending 19 and 20. That told us that we may not be able to meet our load and operating reserve requirements. following procedure 4420, we issued an alert. That's just to give the rest of the utilities a heads up that we anticipate we may not be able to meet our load and reserve obligations. After we issued that, we called around all the neighboring utilities in the Western United States looking to see if there was any other energy available that we could schedule into our system for those tight hours. The response at the time was that many of them were also tight. We couldn't get any commitments to anybody at Solus Energy at the time, but they would reevaluate in real time as the conditions evolved. We get into Friday, August 14th. The load forecast from our forecasting team has increased, and so we anticipate that we would still be tight, that things are not looking any better. There's no additional resources that have come online or that are even available to get online, and no any other energy from neighboring utilities. So we did two things. We issued a flex alert to try to communicate to everybody in California that things could be tight and we needed their help in conserving. We also, per operating procedure 4420, issued it's called a warning. And that is, again, very similar to the alert. It's just a real-time statement of we anticipate we may not be able to meet our load and reserve obligations. So as we continue on through the day, the load is pulling. Thank goodness most of the resources, though, are online and performing. We get to 2:56 p.m., and the load is pulling, but then we have a 500-megawatt generator trip. Per normal operating practice and our procedures, we dispatched our contingency reserves, which are in place to protect us against the loss of a generator or transmission line. We recovered we got our system back into balance with resources and loads. Doing that, we did start up some of our gas-fired peakers that are considered what's called non-spin reserves. So that's energy capacity that's offline. It's not synchronized, but when we call on it, it can hit the system and ramp up within 10 minutes. Once we had those units online, we did not want to shut them down as we knew we were going to be going into a load pull that evening, and many of those resources need to be, once you shut them down, have to stay off for up to an hour before they can be restarted. So we made the decision to keep them online and take other steps that we have available per our procedures to cover our operating reserves. Essentially what we did is we identified that we could call the utilities and drop some firm load if needed for another contingency. We did not actually drop load at that time. We just kept the resources online to meet load and then use identified load if we had to for another contingency. About 20 minutes later, as we were pulling into the ramp, we saw that we were getting tighter and we started to call off some of our demand response. So we, by doing that, our procedures have us jump into a stage two emergency because we were having problems maintaining our reserves and needed to let everybody know that we were walking down our procedure, operating procedure 4420, towards our stage three where there is the load shed. These declarations helped us get some emergency assistance from neighboring utilities so that we were able to then make the next couple of hours from emergency assistance from many of the neighboring utilities throughout California and the Western United States. We had hopes that that would be enough to get us through the peak, and it did actually get us through the peak load. But as soon as the solar started ramping off very quickly and into our what we call our net peak load, we did run out of energy and capacity, and our operating reserves began to go below our requirements, as well as we had an imbalance on our grid of up to 1,200 megawatts. In response to that, we had to go into our stage three emergency and order off firm load. We did it in two blocks of 500 megawatts each, trying to minimize the amount of load we would have to have off, and we did end up being able to just do the two blocks of 500 megawatts. We did that pro rata across our UDCs within California. In fact, the next slide has a little bit more details. If we can go to that, please. This is kind of the sequence I just walked through. But let's see, if we go down to the 5:15 is when we dispatched off the 800 megawatts we had available to us of demand response. So we had given the utilities heads up that we would be needing to call these programs, and so they responded very quickly, and it did help us recover our ACE and keep the system in the hole. About an hour and 20 minutes later, though, is when we began to not be able to meet the load and reserve obligations and had that large negative ACE. So we had insufficient generation to meet our current load and still protect our operating reserves. So this is when we began doing our stage three emergency and load shedding. At 7:56, the system had the load had started to go down, and we were able to begin having a load restored. So it was about an hour and 10 minutes after the last load block before we could get the load back on. And so it was that was the sequence on that day that we did to make sure that we kept our system stable and reliable. One reason that we cannot always use the contingency reserves we have in order to serve load is that I have multiple requirements from NERC and WEC and standards that require that once I've dropped below my reserve requirement, I recover within 1 hour. I also have another standard that tells me that if my system is out of balance between resources and load, and that the ACE I was talking about, the area control error, that imbalance, I have to recover that within 15 minutes. And on that day, the only action, the energy we had left to recover within 15 minutes was the shedding of load and recovering our resources.
John, you mentioned that there are standards we follow that are NERC standards. Those standards are in place for a very good reason. They're there to ensure there's no system collapse.
Right.
When you're at the very edge and you have a contingency and you have no operating reserves, you risk entire system collapse. Is that not fair?
That's correct, Steve. In fact, that afternoon or evening there when we had the negative 1,200 megawatt ACE, if we had deployed our reserves to recover our ACE, but then had a large generator, Diablo Canyon, one of our bigger thermal units trip, I could not have recovered. Would have had our ACE and frequency drop dramatically and put the rest of the interconnection in jeopardy. So that is the reason I need to protect those reserves, so when I do lose a large generator or large transmission line that reduces energy into California, I can return our system to normal and not have that impact the rest of the interconnection.
John, this is Severin. Can you just explain who actually makes this decision to call the utilities and tell them, call the utility distribution companies and tell them to shed load, and what their operating decision making is? They're following.
It's our shift managers. We have the California ISO. We have shift managers 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They actually have a crew that they work with. They're the ones that have been that have the authority to make that decision, make all operational decisions in the control room, and make that decision to shed load. They're primarily operating off of the NERC and WEC standards and our operating procedures. Is what guides them in their decision making.
Thanks.
Any other questions before I move on to Saturday? Okay, let's go ahead and go on to Saturday. It's a shorter sequence of events here. Very similar type of a day. We had the day ahead market also show us infeasible for hour ending 19 and 20, so we had a deficiency of resources for the same 2 hours. We had put out an alert the day before. We did a warning the morning of. As we walked into the day, we did also call on the demand response that we had available from the utility to take off the system. And we were moving into the evening ramp, and throughout the day, the wind had been going up and down a little bit, but in the evening, it actually looked like it was going to start to help us. It ramped very quickly up about 1,000 megawatts and looked like it was going to add some energy on the system. In response, we backed down generation that it's not all needed. So the wind was helping to serve a lot of the load, but we did have some of the generation we could back down slightly as the wind ramped up very fast. About 35 minutes, 40 minutes later, though, it was ramping down quickly, and within 1 hour, it had ramped out 1,400 megawatts. So we had to now dispatch the remaining generation we had available to fill that void that the wind had left. right as we were starting to recover our ACE, we had another generator that ramped very quickly down from 400 megawatts and put us again in an imbalance on our system. And we had no other energy to begin to restore our ACE at that time. And the ship manager knew that we still had the whole evening net load peak to get through, decided he would needed to shed load at the time. So he did make the call. It didn't have to be as large as it was on Friday, but it was 470 megawatts. And we did do a pro rata across the UDCs per our operating procedures. And then shortly after that, about 20 minutes afterwards, the wind did start to ramp back up very quickly. And also having shed load, we were in now a stage three emergency and were able to get emergency assistance from many of the neighboring utilities. And we had a few other resources that we were still moving up that were able to come up. And then also the load started to reduce. And so we were able to get the load that was off back on the system fairly quickly. Again, it was just really a matter of our fleet was pretty much maxed out, and we become somewhat dependent on imports and the renewable energies at that time. And on Saturday, we had seen some volatility in the desert on the solar resources, and luckily it had cleared out at some point, but then the winds were ramping up and down. That is visible actually on our website under the Today's Outlook. You can see some of the large swings we had on the solar and wind. That. Any questions on Saturday?
John, I have one. This is Mary. How long were customers inconvenienced on Saturday? Or how quickly were we able to restore?
It was about 20 minutes from the time that we had ordered the load off until we called back and told them they could start to restore the load. Each utility has their own program for taking the load off and putting it on. So as far as the amount of time that they're off, we'd have to check the utilities. We just give each of the UDCs the instruction to take it off and then let them know that you can begin restoring it. But the time from us was 20 minutes between the time of taking ordering it off until we were called them back and told them they could begin to restore load.
Thank you.
I think it's, Mary, if I might just add on to that. This is Steve. I want to make it very clear to everyone that these load sheds are things we order. The utilities are required to follow those instructions, and they do. I know there's some confusion that the utilities might actually be doing this load drop. They are doing it. They're executing it at our direction.
Okay. If there's no other questions on the Friday and Saturday events, I can give you just a brief outlook into today and tomorrow. So, the day-ahead market for yesterday ran, and it came up infeasible for many more hours, not just averaging 19 and 20 for today. It actually was averaging 15 through 21. So we have 6 hours that we have a resource deficiency for today and in much larger numbers. So we did issue an alert, a flex alert. This morning we issued a warning, and these are all per our operating procedure 4420. And are anticipating that we will be into issuing off the demand response products and going into a stage two emergency to be able to dispatch any of our operating resources that are providing operating reserve to try to continue to serve load and counting firm load as something I could interrupt in 10 minutes to provide my contingency reserves. We still feel even taking those actions, though, we're going to have insufficient supply for today, and we'll need to go into stage three and drop firm load. The graph is just showing that it goes down to as much as 4,400 megawatts of resource deficiency, averaging 19, and 20, I think, was 4,300. So we have 2 hours of over 4,000 megawatts of deficiency. We are calling again all the neighboring utilities and working with everybody we can to try to secure additional energy. So we're hoping that number will not be that large, but the reality is right now that is what I'm looking at. For tomorrow, the load is even forecast to be higher. And the day-ahead market is running as we speak, and we'll have the results shortly. But as of now, we're not sure how large of a number the deficiency would be for tomorrow.
John,
John, this is Angelina. Can you please say again, what is our total system capacity?
Mark is going to, Angelina, if you'll hold that question, Mark will cover that in just a couple of minutes.
Okay, and if we can also cover what has been the highest peak that we've had to date, and are these peaks higher than what we've experienced before?
To date or ever?
Ever.
Well, the highest peak we ever had was July 24th, 2006. I believe it was 50,270,
yes.
If I recall correctly. In 2017, we had a, I think it was 2017, we had a peak of 50,140, something like that, 150 thereabouts. So at 2006, a little bit of a background on that, was a very similar weather event to what we're facing now. Very hot, very expanded throughout the entire West. When we pulled the load on 2017, let me go back to 2006. In 2006, also for context, we had a lot more capacity on the system. We had San Onofre for 2,200 megawatts, as I recall, and we had a number of other plants on the system totaling thousands of megawatts that were there in 2006 that are not there today. In 2017, largely, we were able to meet the gap because of imports, and that was because California was hot, but the rest of the West was not that hot. So that's a little bit of historical a look back on what's transpired prior to the current loads.
Great. It would be good to also have a comparison of what capacity we had in those years and why we came close, but we were able to ride it through, and the information on the heat wave in the West not being as great as it is now. So we've hit the perfect storm. Lower
yes.
capacity, it's hot throughout the West, and we don't have enough of the resources, and we cannot count on as many imports.
That's exactly right, Angelina. As a matter of fact, on Friday night at Net Peak, which is the 7 o'clock hour, correct me, John, if I'm wrong, we had 5,900 megawatts of imports.
Correct.
And on, you know, if you didn't have the heat in the West and everybody competing for resources, that number could have easily been 10,000.
This
right.
is Severin. Can I add one question or comment? My memory of the 2006 heat storm is that it was drier than this, and that as a result, the lows at night were lower than we've gotten because the humidity was not holding the heat. Have we done any analysis of that at this point? Or
this is Mark Rothiter. I think that's pretty accurate. This is probably a more humid event. Cloud cover, especially at night, creates almost a blanket over the system where the heat will stay there overnight. So you're starting from a higher temperature starting point, meaning that the air conditioners are already starting up earlier in the morning, and your ability to go to higher loads and the comfort level is significantly less comfortable, causing the air conditioners to be used more.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, Severin, I think you didn't ask this question, but I'd also note there's been a fairly significant migration in the load centers to inland suburbs, particularly in the Bay Area and in the LA basin, and that has, you know, driven up a lot of air conditioning load.
Yeah, the change in the demography of the state is
yeah.
definitely playing a role.
Just to add one more.
So I assume also that there's obviously been a lot more rooftop solar installed between 2006 and today, and that would also change the shape of the load curve.
Yes, Ash, I think that's an important point to make. We today we're going to have a very difficult time meeting the gross peak. We're not going to meet the gross peak. But normally we have, and the rooftop solar helps us with that. In the net peak, in the later evening hours, in 7 and 8 p.m., when we have a lot of load on the system, obviously the rooftop solar is no longer contributing. So it helps at certain parts of the day and obviously not at others. And for us, it shows up as load coming back onto the system as that rooftop solar stops producing. And John's team on Friday and Saturday night, I know, experienced sort of that load. The load pull continued after it got dark, basically, and a lot of that load pull, we think, was because of rooftop solar customers coming back on the system.
And Steve, this is Mary. Can you talk a little bit about what a customer can do, you know, to prepare and help with this?
Yeah, Mary, if you don't mind, both that question and the capacity question that Angelina asked earlier, we're going to cover that, and Mark is going to give an overview of sort of what the fleet looks like, as well as actions we've taken and actions customers can take.
Great.
Dave, it might be, unless there's more questions, Mr. Chairman, it might be a good time to segue to Mark.
Yes, let's do that. John, thank you very much. I'm sure there will be more questions when we get to the public comment period. I will also mention that this presentation will be posted to the ISO website later this afternoon. So for everyone, we've had several questions already about that. You'll be able to get this presentation on the ISO website later this afternoon. But let's go ahead with the next presentation. I believe Mark Rothleder.
Yes. Next slide, please. Hi, I'm Mark Rothleder. I'm the Vice President of Market Policy and Performance. And I will go through some slides that will answer the question about the capacity of the system to serve demand. I will make a comparison to what we're actually experiencing for today, and then some mitigation measures that we have taken and some recommendations. In terms of the capacity to meet demand, we rely, as Steve mentioned earlier, on those resources that are available and contracted and procured through resource adequacy programs. And I say programs because each local regulatory authority has their administration of their programs. The CPUC is the largest local regulatory authority, having jurisdiction over the large investor-owned utilities and the load-serving entities within them. So those resources are what we rely on to meet and dispatch to balance to meet demand. And I should really say demand plus meeting the reserve obligations that John had talked about earlier. But if I just put it in terms of demand, the capacity that we have available that we can serve is about 46,000 megawatts based on the capacity that is actually procured, contracted, and shown to us under the resource adequacy programs. Now, I say approximately because this number, ultimately what can be served, is dependent and does move around, and it is affected by things like resource and transmission outages, and if a resource trips or is unavailable, that could reduce the availability. If there's some additional resources that potentially are not contracted, there is some opportunity to be able to serve more. In terms of transmission outages, if there are things like fires under the lines or there is work going on in the transmission system, and it doesn't necessarily have to be our transmission system, there can be outages in other parts of the interconnected grid that affect our ability to import energy into the system that can affect our ability to get to that 46,000 capability. The next one is availability of imports, and there's two things that affect the availability of imports, actually three. One is, are they contracted for? Two is the transmission and the capability to move it into the California system available. And then lastly is the supply available from the neighboring balancing areas. And that's dependent on the actual load conditions in their area versus the supply conditions in their area. And on a day or on conditions like we're experiencing now, this is a region-wide heat event. The temperatures are extreme across the West. Portland was hitting 90 degrees or nearly 100 degrees yesterday, and I believe Seattle was up above 90 to 95 degrees. With those types of temperatures across the West, the availability of any excess supply beyond what was contracted will significantly be impacted. The next impact is things like cloud cover. So like on the conditions that we're experiencing, not only is it a heat event, but you've got cloud cover and moisture that can affect the availability of solar production, especially across in the desert area. And we have large amounts and reliance of these solar resources at this point. Other weather conditions can also affect things like wind production. During the hottest, steelest part of the day, although we have nearly about 5,000 megawatts plus of wind capacity, the actual production of wind during the hottest part of the day could be near zero. Other things, such as hydro conditions, which are not immediately affected by the conditions of the day, but more the conditions of the earlier winter conditions, if it's a low hydro event winter, in other words, not a lot of rain, the availability and the amount of energy available in the hydro system can be impacted. And when you get towards the end of the summer, that can actually reduce the amount of available hydro production available towards the end of the summer season. Lastly, the conventional resources are also affected by ambient conditions, the temperature. At higher temperatures, the available production from the gas resources may be impacted, and they will not be able to produce as much as they would have at lower temperatures. What I just described in terms of capacity to meet the system peak, effectively around 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock in the afternoon, is exactly that. It's the ability to meet that gross peak. The concern is that when 2 hours later, when the sun goes down, that 46,000 megawatt capacity is now reduced to 43,000 megawatts of capacity. And that's because the solar production and the capability also drops down to zero. Next slide, please. So if I characterize that and compare it to the conditions that we're experiencing today on August 17th, what you see here is the demand curve, and you can see this on the website. We are forecasting a peak load at around 5 to 6 p.m. of about 49,700 megawatts. As I indicated, our capacity to meet that peak demand is about 46,000 megawatts. That's the gap that we're dealing with from an operational condition. The issue does not go away as the evening progresses. Although the load decreases somewhat to about 47,400 at 8 p.m., but so does our capacity to meet that what we call net peak load, which drops down to 43,000. So the gap, and frankly speaking, the operational challenge that we experience now is more around that net peak event. The solar is ramping out fast, and we've got to ramp other resources up quickly to meet that later net peak. Next slide, please. So we've been taking several measures to try to fill in that gap. On a typical day, we do not have that gap, and we can rely on the resource adequacy, resource capacity to meet the demand. However, on days like this, where that gap exists, on a typical days where we have high temperatures and high loads in California, but the rest of the West is under normal conditions, we can collaborate and find energy on the market from our neighbors. And that's how we have traditionally in the past, when we meet those high load days, even though that we may be extended beyond our resource adequacy capacity, we're able to find energy across the West and import it in. And we're able to do that because we can get to the 10,000, 11,000 megawatts coming in from outside the area. Currently, what is contracted under the resource adequacy programs is about 6,500 megawatts. So, and as Steve mentioned earlier, we're seeing about that level, sometimes a little bit less, sometimes a little bit more, actually being able to come in across that peak and net peak period. If we could get to those higher import levels and there was actually supply available, we would have been able to meet these level of loads. So, as a result of that, we are actively collaborating with numerous utilities in California, both within our balancing area and outside of our balancing area, also with the California Energy Commission, the CPUC, and our neighboring balancing areas to find as much energy as we possibly can, including potentially additional resources that have were either out of service or were unavailable. We're trying to find if there's any resources that we can find to start. In addition, we've issued flex alerts and warnings that John had described earlier, and I won't go into those. You're aware of those. From outside the area, we are trying to scour and find and procure as much available energy, emergency energy, as we can. As John mentioned, as we declare certain levels of emergency, it allows us and authorizes us and obligates our neighbors to make any emergency energy available that they can to help their neighbors. It's the part of the assistance program made up of the regional construct. We've called upon demand response programs and other demand relief, including Department of Water Resources, to shift pumping load away from these critical hours. As of yesterday evening, we've executed a search for any additional capacity that may be out there. We have the authority under our capacity procurement mechanism, which is a backstop procurement mechanism to the resource adequacy program. We are searching and basically soliciting any capacity for the next 30 days so that we can fill up that difference between what we're seeing as kept capacity and what actually we're seeing in terms of actual energy needs. We also suspended what we call convergence bidding in the day ahead market so that we have clearer indication between what is clearing in terms of physical resources. Lastly, we have put demand, and when I say demand, I'm also including potentially some exports on notice that there could be curtailment. With regards to those exports I just mentioned, there are exports that actually are contracted with some resources within the balancing area or are wheeling through the system. Those are contracted and those cannot be curtailed. However, there are other uncontracted exports for which we have the authority and we will curtail those if need be. With that, I will answer any questions.
As we move to Q&A, please press #2 on your telephone keypad to enter the question queue. You will hear a notification when your line is unmuted. At that time, please then state your name and questions. Once again, pressing pound 2 will indicate that you wish to ask a question.
Can I ask
Mark,
a question?
Oh. Yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Severin.
Okay. We have 46,000 megawatts of resource adequacy at the peak and 43,000 at the net peak. Can you say anything at this point, or is this part of a postmortem about how much of the shortfall, well, this is for going forward, but for Friday and Saturday, is failure of contracted resource adequacy to perform, and how much is a shortage of resource adequacy?
I'll leave that to postmortem, but there were outages, and there's always outages on some resources, including resource adequacy resources, and I believe those outages probably were in the neighborhood of about 1,500 to 1,600 megawatts, depending on the particular hour. In addition to that, as John...
But I think it's worth noting, John, maybe you can say this, that number strikes me as being relatively low compared to on an average day.
Yeah, I would say that the current outage rate on our resources is probably C ever. I mean, our peak load days usually do show up. But yeah, we're at outage levels right now, probably lowest part of the lowest that we've seen the whole year and probably the last 2 years even.
Yeah, so Severin, I think our outage levels, we're not seeing any evidence whatsoever of people not performing if they can.
I had sort of two issues. One is that, is there evidence of any sort of withholding? But the other is the numbers on slide 8 with the maximum capacity based on shown resource adequacy, those do not derate for any sort of typical outages.
These account for those outages that I just described. They don't account for what John described as the unexpected trip of the resource. So if you see this 43,000 at that 8 p.m., a 500 megawatt trip of a resource, if we were on the edge, that would throw us over the edge of not being able to meet our load plus reserve responsibility. We were on the edge. In terms of your question about any kind of withholding observations, there is no evidence that I have seen of any kind of withholding. There are outages, though, and those outages are relatively normal or low relative to historical patterns.
Great, thanks.
Mark, this is Mary. I'm just going back to my question I asked earlier that Steve asked me to ask now, which is what the public can do, because the flex alerts, even though those aren't things that we do, that utilities and others do, I think people will be interested to know, given this extreme heat and this unusual condition, how their behavior can help be part of the solution.
Mary, it's Steve Berberick. We, in our flex alert statement yesterday, we suggested the following. That people set their air conditioning from 3 to 10. We're asking customers to set the air conditioning thermostat to 78 degrees, assuming their health is not imperiled doing that. Defer use of major appliances, turn off unnecessary lights, unplug unused electrical devices, close blinds and drapes, use fans when possible, and limit the time the refrigerator door is open. We're also asking, beyond the norm that I kind of noted, we would like people to consider pre-cooling their homes earlier in the day and lower their air conditioning thermostats to 72 degrees and then raise it in the afternoon when we need conservation. Obviously, charge electric vehicles early in the day. Charge mobile devices on laptops early in the day, and run the major appliances early in the day. Also, there's not an insignificant amount of pool pump load that we have here in the state. Setting those to run in the morning or late at night would also be very helpful.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Because I think that's really critical that people who are on the grid can help be part of the solution. And in terms of the interruption time, you know, I know you're doing everything to minimize it. Do you have a sense of what that's going to look like today and tomorrow?
I'll do it, Mary. I'll do this. Right now, we expect outages because we can't meet the gross load this afternoon to start perhaps as early as 3. They start in about 100 megawatts at 3 and then ramp up to about 4,000 megawatts at 7 p.m. I believe 6 p.m. is around that same kind of shortage level. The utilities will rotate those outages generally on an hourly basis. So most people, depending on the utility, should see an outage, I'm going to say 2 hours probably, to give the utility an hour to restore. Some of the utilities will take longer, or customers may take longer because just where they are situated on the system. I believe the utilities and communications I've had with their executive management, we're going to do everything they can to make it so the outages are where they can restore them reasonably quickly. So that's what we could expect. I also want everyone to be assured that we are scouring every corner of our world to find additional load reductions and generation. And I have been in contact with the Northwest Grid operators. They are running their system at max and sending us everything we can get through the transmission system limits. We have gotten very good cooperation from the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. They have agreed to provide us assistance today and tomorrow and beyond as we need it. The Department of Defense has agreed to reduce their load. On and on, we've had a lot of great response from industry and commercial entities, and we hope that can continue. To the extent we can narrow the gap of, you know, 4,000 megawatts and narrow it to something much smaller, we will do everything we possibly can to do that.
And Steve, this won't affect vital services, like it won't affect hospitals, right?
Well, Mary, we don't do the outages. The utilities actually execute them, and I'm not an expert on their outage rotations, but I do believe they protect critical infrastructure like hospitals and police stations and such facilities.
Terrific.
Are there any more questions from the board before we move to public comment? Hearing none, we are very glad that we have more than 500 people dialed in, but given the very large number of people, we are going to have to limit comments and questions to no more than 2 minutes. We will take written questions after this event. The address for sending your questions will be posted on the ISO board page right next to the presentation that that John Phipps and Mark Rothleder went through this morning. So with that, operator, would you please repeat the instructions for people wanting to ask a question?
Absolutely. If you have a question or a comment, please press #2 on your telephone keypad to enter the question queue. You will hear a notification when your line is unmuted, At that time, please then state your name and question. And just as a reminder, if you press pound 2 again, it will lower your hand. So unless your question has already been answered, please do not lower your hand or you'll be back at the bottom of the queue.
So our Assistant Corporate Secretary, Stacey Carpenter, will announce a two-minute limit, but we'll take the first question or comment.
Hi, this is Carrie Bentley with the Western Power Trading Forum. Mark, I was wondering if you could tell everyone what the August resource adequacy system requirement was and let us know if any load-serving entities were deficient. And I'm wondering if this was a planning time frame deficiency or an operational deficiency. Thanks.
Anybody deficient? I think there were letters submitted on that. But in terms of the total target, I believe it was 45,289 based on the CEC forecast for 2020 August.
Mark,
The RA has the planning reserve.
Carrie,
yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, Carrie, I think that, Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, aren't those any deficiencies or otherwise, are they not on the PUC website, or how are they available otherwise?
I believe they are, but I don't know where to point to them.
Okay.
By the way, that's the load forecast driver. The requirement is then 115% of that, which is the planning reserve margin to cover effectively operating reserve, the 6% operating reserve, plus the a certain amount of outages and potential forecast error, which takes you to the 115%. So that's the requirement that the load serving entities in aggregate have to meet.
Thank you, Mark. I think.
Okay, we'll go on to the next question. Thank you, Carrie. Operator, next question.
Please go ahead. Hi, your line is open. Please make sure your phone isn't set to mute.
Yes, is this for me?
Yes.
Yes, hi, I'm Steve Vogelsang. I live out here in the Coachella Valley, and we have the AC cycling discount thing going. But Southern Cal Edison has been cutting us off at 120 degrees for 5 hours with no cooling centers available thanks to COVID-19. I was wondering if you guys realize the difference between Coachella Valley and San Francisco as far as temperature, because we're exceeding 100 and probably averaging 115 to 17 for August at least. And I'm wondering what you plan on doing with it. And as far as the customers such as myself who have lived here for 35 years and it's getting worse and worse, and I can't see how you guys can't figure out certain hot areas in California, such as San Fernando Valley and a couple other places. This doesn't seem to be a reasonable use of your guys' time and intellect. You guys should figure this out a little better, and I don't even know why you guys have this kind of power to switch off people that actually need the cooling.
If I might, this is Steve Berberick, the CEO of the ISO. I think you're referring to the Edison Air Conditioning Cycling Program. We don't directly control that. It would be a question for Edison. Not that we are ducking it, but I don't know the details of how they cycle your air conditioning. I will note, in case you're interested in sympathy, we're actually in Folsom in the Central Valley, and it's supposed to be
108 here today, so we're sympathetic.
Can you still hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I did talk to Southern Cal Edison today at length to find out, and they told me directly they get the information from ISO because of California law to stop certain, to cut people off. That was their thing. They got it direct from ISO.
Fair enough. We take your concern.
And that's the two-minute mark.
Yes. Operator, next question, please.
Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. This is a consumer, and I started working with the SGIP program to do solar and power walls for battery backup, partially so that we can offload our input on the grid. Do you guys have anything to say about the SGIP program and, like, how consumers can help balance load more than just, you know, what we've already talked about?
Sure. This is Mark Rothleder. I think the SGIP program, to the extent the battery and the solar resources can help offload the system, it certainly helps us on days like this to reduce the load. And if there was an interruption, I believe your batteries would also allow you to continue to meet some of your load, even though you may be disconnected or interrupted from the grid. So I think it works good for you, and it helps unload the system.
This is Severin. Can I add a couple of things in response to the last two questions? One is, it's important, and I think with such a big crowd on the line, this may not be well known, to make the distinction that the California ISO operates the bulk power grid and delivers powers to the distribution systems of PG&E and Southern California Edison and all the utilities. The utilities are the ones who make the decisions about which circuits, when they have to consume less from the bulk power grid, which circuits that they are going to cut off. Likewise, the utilities are the ones who, with the CPUC, actually implement programs like SGIP, I'm pretty sure. While it certainly impacts the ISO, it isn't something that the ISO is directly managing or responsible for.
That's a really good clarification, Severin. Thank you very much. And we'll go to the next question, please. And once again, everyone, due to priority of our operational requirements today, we're going to have to end this call directly at 12:30. But we'll take questions and comments until then. So, operator, next question, please.
Yeah, please go ahead. Make sure your line is not muted. Hi, your line is open. Area code 541. Okay.
Maybe on to the next question, operator.
Yep. Hi, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can.
Yes.
This is Habib Maiga with SDG&E. Just a general question regarding energy-only resources. Were there including that 46,000 number, or was the 46,000 number only RA-type resources? And then if the answer to that is those energy-only resources were not included, is there a way to also use energy-only resources to just to close the gap?
So the answer is that a energy-only resource would not have deliverability, would not count towards resource adequacy resources. I'm sorry, towards the resource adequacy target. That said, if those energy-only resources were not constrained, they may be able to provide energy on a given day, but they would be susceptible to being constrained because the transmission system may not be there to support them. And so that's why we can't rely on them for resource adequacy. But you are correct, they may be producing energy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Operator, next question, please.
Hi, your line is open, and please state your name and affiliation.
Good afternoon. This is Ann Rendall, a commissioner from the Washington State Public Utilities Commission, and I appreciate you making this call available. My question is, given the situation in California and the outreach to balancing authorities neighboring, are there things that retail customers in other states can do, and is there any coordination with other states to assist California in this issue?
Mr. Chair, do you want me to answer that?
Yes, please.
Commissioner Rendall, it's nice to hear from you. I hope you're well. Certainly, any reduction of load in neighboring areas would allow more power to be available that we could use. So that would be welcome. Along the same lines of what I talked about from conservation measures that I spoke to earlier. Sending those out, however you might be able to do that, Commissioner, would be very helpful. As it relates to coordinating with the other states directly about this, we have not done that, but I think that's an excellent idea, and we will look and see if there's further coordination we've done. We have done that with inside California entities, LADWP and SMUD and others. So expanding that outreach would certainly be valuable, and we welcome that. Thank you for the suggestion.
Thank you.
Steve, if I can, this is Severin, if I can just add a clarification because I don't want you to be misunderstood. We have reached out on the supply side outside of California, correct?
That is correct.
Just your reference was only to reaching out on demand conservation outside of California.
Yeah, and I guess to that point, this is just Mark, to that point, I think the expanded answer is, as we reached out and the other utilities outside of the state are aware of our issues that we're having, but also the extreme temperatures and load that they're experiencing, I believe most of them are also doing similar conservation programs within their jurisdiction.
Yeah, we note, Commissioner, that it's hot up in Seattle as well.
Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hello?
Yes, please state your name and affiliation.
Tom Baker, Channel 2 News, San Francisco Bay Area. I guess this question is for the CEO. Given that global warming is a real thing, exactly who rebuffed you and therefore failed to provide the ISO with adequate capacity, and how long is it going to take to resolve this? Because this performance since Friday has not been exactly exemplary, especially given the short notice. And in one case, PG&E noticed people of the cutoff of their power a half hour after they did it.
Yeah, if I could take those in reverse, as far as the short notice goes, I don't know which day, sir, that you were impacted. We own that issue. As I stated earlier, we believed that there would be adequate supply to cover the demand. We were wrong, and as a result, there were little or short notice given to the utilities, and obviously then they couldn't do that either. It's not their fault. It's ours. And we apologize about that. As it relates
to the first part, there's an extensive resource adequacy program in California that's administered by the Public Utility Commission and given to all jurisdictional load-serving entities. I think in collaboration with the Public Utilities Commission, we're going to have to work on this issue. I know that they're aware of it, and I have been in discussion with commissioners, and we are going to work diligently. I will also note that the governor's office has done a tremendous amount to try to respond to this, including trying to get load reductions and additional power from wherever we could get it. But they have also been very good at looking forward to how we can address the current situation, but also look forward to how we resolve it in the longer term. So we will work with the Public Utility Commission on the resource adequacy program to make sure that you have the reliability that you deserve.
Now, please answer the question. Who rebuffed you? Answer the question.
Well, it should be evident. I mean, we made these comments to the Public Utility Commission.
Well, the CPUC does not have.
Sir, please go ahead.
No, I'm here. The CPUC has proven itself not to be a good regulator of utilities, especially in the electric and gas area. Now you're telling me that you're relying on the California Public Utilities Commission with its sterling record to tell you what to do, and therefore leading to the cutoff of all these people now and in the future.
This is Severin Borenstein. I think that you're sort of construing this as this CAISO somehow has the power to tell the CPUC what to do, which it doesn't. Certain decisions are made by different entities in the state. The CAISO or the CPUC is the entity that is assigned to make resource adequacy decisions. CAISO participates in that process. If there is a problem with that process, it's not something CAISO can just say, well, we'll do it instead and take it over. It's something that it's a decision that has to be made much higher up. So I understand your point, but I think that it's blaming the CAISO for following the law is inappropriate.
We are at the 2 minutes.
Good, let's see.
Hi.
Operator, please go to the next question.
Please go ahead, your line is open. And state your name and affiliation. Hi, please make sure your phone isn't set to mute.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
My name is Justin Mills. I was curious if you guys have worked with the COI to get the rating increase from 3,400 up to 4,600 or 4,800.
Yes, we have. RC West, who is the reliability coordinator for most of the Western Interconnection, reached out to BPA on Friday and Saturday, and they've been helping us and assisting us increase the scheduling limit on COI on both days, and we've already reached out to them for today also.
Yeah, and by way of background, I might add, for those of you who are listening, the COI is the California-Oregon Intertie. It's a transmission path. Its full capacity is 4,800 megawatts from north to south, and it's derated right now, I think, to 3,600, but I think John is correct that there are studies that have been done. I think we're going to be shortly, if not have already, increased it to 3,900. Is that right, John?
Correct. Yeah, this is John Phipps. Yeah, that's correct. On Friday, they increased it to 4,100, and the discussions with RC West and BPA today are to get at least to that level, if not higher, today.
Yeah, and I personally reached out to some of the utilities in the Northwest. There's some work that's being done at the Grizzly substation that is limiting flow on COI,
And I spoke with them about speeding up that work, and they committed to do that. So we will endeavor to try to get the rating up to full capacity as soon as we can. It's a good question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Operator, next question, please.
Hi, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, CAISO Governors Steve, this is Alex Morris with the California Energy Storage Alliance. You know, we're interested in being part of the solution for the grid, and I know we're still a relatively small proportion of the generating capacity in your system. Do you have any information about how storage has performed in the past couple of days that we can take back to our members and try to, you know, educate the industry on how we can help support the system during this time?
Alex, as you know, we have about 200 megawatts of storage on the system right now. I think it was dispatched to its full capability. We would have to do a bit of digging to see exactly what it was serving. In other words, was it bidding into ancillary services? Was it providing regulation? Or was it doing, I'll call it load curve arbitrage, for lack of a better term?
Sure.
I don't know offhand. John, do you have any?
No, I do tend to monitor it occasionally, but I didn't look at it for Friday or Saturday.
I took a look, and it looked like it was producing around 200 during that time, but it fluctuates.
But Alex, to your point, though, obviously with a renewable-heavy system, storage is going to be critical important. We have 200 megawatts now. We're going to need thousands of megawatts. But I do want to caution, storage has to be charged. And so any energy being produced to serve load is not going into storage, and we'll need to make sure that we plan the system so that we have enough capacity to charge the batteries and serve the load.
Okay, and we stand ready to help, so thanks, and feel free to use me as a conduit if you want to outreach for anything to the storage industry. Thanks, and good luck with this difficult situation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Please go ahead and state your name and affiliation. Please make sure your phone isn't set to mute. Okay, move on to the next caller. Hi, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, given the remarks by the CEO about how these problems would not have occurred had the San Onofre nuclear plant still been operating, can you say whether you'll recommend to Governor Newsom to keep Diablo Canyon operating? And I'd love to hear from the other governors, too.
This is Steve Burbrick. I was actually, San Onofre would not have fixed this all by itself. It was 2,200 megawatts. Certainly it would have been helpful. But as far as it's been gone now for several years, so I think we've been able to manage the grid well beyond that. As it relates to Diablo Canyon, I think that first of all, it would have to be relicensed, and I believe the period to even attempt to relicense that probably passed. So I don't think that's a possibility, and I wouldn't advocate for that with the governor.
Can I add something? We have advocated at the CPUC that timely and aggressive procurement is authorized to address the imminent retirement of the Diablo Canyon. So the 3,300 megawatts that's already been authorized does not cover that that retirement of Diablo Canyon. So we need to start now to start getting the additional resources to cover the loss of the opportunity.
Can I hear from the other governors?
Dave Olson.
I'm hearing Severin Borenstein.
Sure.
I will actually comment. Go ahead, Dave. You go first.
So I would point out that inflexible nuclear is a very bad partner for a low-carbon very flexible grid with lots of wind and solar generation. Nuclear cannot be easily or quickly ramped up and down, and the grid that we are moving toward requires great flexibility, much more flexibility than we have available today. So nuclear provides a lot of inflexible energy, but with wind and solar, we have a lot of energy, wind and solar and storage. So long term, nuclear is just not a good fit for the kind of system that we and other states that are decarbonizing are moving toward.
I'll just add a couple things. One is, I just want to make sure nobody misunderstands what Steve said. I don't think Steve actually said that this would not have happened but for San Onofre. What he said is in 2006, we had San Onofre. A lot of things were different in 2006 than today. My view is that it isn't the CAISO's role to recommend or reject specific projects. Our job is to give feedback on what different projects would do to the grid. There's a lot of policy being made in California with respect to renewables and decarbonizing. CAISO doesn't make that policy. We are not going to recommend a specific unit. We are going to say, here's what the ramifications are. And as Steve said, when Diablo, I think it's probably when, goes out, it's our job to say, here's what we need to replace that and make sure we maintain reliability.
And what would we need? Wouldn't we just need more natural gas?
That's a long discussion, and it depends on the state of storage unit, depends on the state of existing natural gas, and it depends on the state of demand response. So, no,
but, it's 2,200 megawatts. It sounds like, though, what you were saying or what Steve was saying is that more solar isn't going to be able to replace 2,200 megawatts of nuclear.
Well, there's no question more solar is not going to replace 7 p.m. energy generation after the sun has gone down. Solar plus storage could. I think this is more a question of technology and cost.
Yeah, I think that's the important point. This is Mary, that we're moving forward with a low carbon grid, and I think the direction's really clear, and we're not going back. We're not going backwards. We're going to move forward.
We are at 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you for the question. Operator, please go to the next caller.
Hi, please go ahead. State your name and affiliation.
Yes, this is Mark Nelson of Radiant Energy Fund of San Francisco. Just making sure you can hear me.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So I was noting that Mary said we're moving forward. Presumably the power outages are not moving forward, and nor is the flexible grid that had the power outages. It sounds like it's flexible now, but there are power outages now. Is there a comment you can make about whether Coastal Commission action to shut down coastal plants that are not affected by inland heat, is that contributing to the effects we're seeing on the grid today?
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to take a stab at that?
Sure. You or Mark, I think.
Oh, let's let Mark do it. Thank you, Steve. So I think we're, just to be clear, you're referring to the once through cooler resource. Okay. So
yes,
we're still, yeah, so there have been some once through cooler resources that have shut down. There have been some that have been repowered and replaced. But if you compare it to, let's say, 2006, yes, there's less once-through-cooled resources than there were previously. There are still some once-through-cooled resources that are scheduled for shutdown. They're originally scheduled for shutdown at the end of this year, but as a result of some identified shortfalls of capacity that Steve mentioned earlier, there are some decisions that have to be made about extending those so that we can transition to the new resources that have been authorized.
That's a work in progress. I believe there's some decision that will be made on September 1st by the water boards to address that. That's.
Okay, thank you very much. And I just add that the NRC does allow nuclear plants in good standing to pursue licenses after their license has expired. So good thing we can clear that up. Thank you very much, guys.
Would you like to take one more person?
We can do one more, and that will be the last question.
All right, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Emily Turner with KPIX 5 in San Francisco. The predictions for the seven-day forecast show these triple-digit temperatures well in advance. At what point did you guys not realize this was going to be a problem, and at what point and where does the buck stop?
Thank you for your question. It's Steve Berberick. We knew last week that we expected a high-pressure system generating a lot of heat over the west. And what we did not know, though, is what the temperatures would look like. I know your company, as an example, does forecasts for the public, and I'm sure you're aware of the variability that you have as they develop. So we knew that it was going to be warm. We did not know how much nor how expanded. We did know probably Wednesday was the first we had our forecasts fed into our system that indicated that Friday and into the coming week we would have issues. That day we issued a grid maintenance restriction to make sure we could keep everything online. And I think Mr. Phipps explained earlier the steps that were taken to try to ensure reliability on Friday and Saturday. I noted in my comments that we felt like we could get Friday and Saturday covered with the resources that we had. The problem that occurred is that there was a rapidly diminishing reserve pool in the rest of the West that we normally draw on, and that made conditions tight. So those are our thoughts.
This is Severin. If I can add a couple of things. One is, even if you know a week in advance, if everybody knows a week in advance, like the people who might sell us imports, that they're going to be hot too, they're not going to sell imports a week in advance because they're worried about their own systems. This is something that has to be addressed on a longer-term basis. A one-week forecast is not really the solution. It's recognizing this. And to that point, I would point you to the CAISO summer assessment that it put out, I believe, in January, saying that the summer was going to, this summer was going to be tight, and summer 2021 was going to be tighter. So this is not a surprise in the large. CAISO actually was modeling this and pointing out the problem back in January that we're facing today.
So is this going to be something that we see in the future? I mean, is this the new normal that we need to expect rolling blackouts?
I will tell you, I don't think it should be, and I think there are definitely ways to avoid it happening, but we need to take very seriously the need for changing the resource adequacy system, as Steve mentioned at the top, in order to be ready for these, which, among other things, means taking realistic views of what can be delivered from solar and when, and what can be delivered from demand response programs and when, and likewise for storage, and likewise for fossil plants. So I think that it's going to require a real reassessment of the capacities in all of these resources.
So the short answer would be yes, this, we could see more of these moving forward.
Yeah, this is Mary.
It depends.
I will. If we don't do what we should do, yes, we could see more of these moving forward. But I think that we can make changes that would avoid that. But none of those changes is going to happen between now and November 1st or something. That is for this season. So I think that we are in a bind. Something that the CAISO pointed out has been pointing out for a long time.
Mary, did you have one?
Yeah, I was just gonna echo what Severin just said. That I think that's right. That CAISO has done a good job over time with this, with balancing this, and I don't think they got caught short not understanding the problem or communicating it. So in that way, I don't think that's the issue. I think now we just have to move forward more decisively on fixing things we know need to be fixed.
With that, we're going to wrap up this meeting. We thank everyone for participating today. Let me remind everyone that the presentations will be available on the ISO website, along with an address to send any written questions to, and we will answer them as quickly as we can. So thank you, and we are now adjourned. Operator, thank you very much. Please close the call.
That concludes our conference. Thank you for using Event Services. You may now disconnect.